scrapbooking these days has a reputation as a hobby for extreme crafters, maybe, or as something that requires just the right paper, album, tools, stickers, templates. It's more than that, though, and it has a long history. Our next guest once had a collection of over 200 older scrapbooks dating from the beginning of the 19th century to the present and containing all kinds of things, remnants of hair, obituary clips, fabric swatches, remnants of everyday life. Jessica Helfand is an artist, designer, and writer. She's a founding editor of Design Observer and the author of several books, including Scrapbooks in American History and her latest, Face, A Visual Odyssey. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, you had built up this big collection of scrapbooks. What opened the door, or I guess the cover, of the scrapbook world for you?
Well, I come from a family of collectors, so you couldn't come to the dinner table without talking about a collection. So it's part of my DNA to look to amass something that I can make sense of. And these things are actually quite compelling because they're so sort of raw and emotional and personal, and yet they start to speak to each other if you look at them as a cultural historian, which I'm a visual historian. I'm interested in the social history of why people make things. And it became very interesting to me that unlike scrapbooks today, which follow certain canonical conventional formats, 100 years ago, they were not formatted at all. They were not gendered. They were not beacons of meaning about anything more than whatever the maker wanted them to be. And in that way, they were, as I say in the book, sort of, you know, outsider art with insider knowledge.
What kind of things did some of the earliest scrapbook creators that you discovered, what kind of things did they collect?
Well, they were interested in sort of rescuing things. And there's a beautiful kind of carpe diem, seizing the day notion of rescuing the things in your midst and cementing them to the page. And it's interesting we're talking about scrapbooks during a moment of incredible social unrest, because one of the things I found in my research is that people started to keep scrapbooks long ago in the days of certainly Thomas Jefferson was a big scrapbook keeper. Mark Twain was a big scrapbook keeper. But there was always a surge in the keeping of journals and the visual rescue, the physical rescue of evidence during times of political and social unrest and upheaval, really going back to the Civil War. The ones that I collected were primarily between about 1850 and 1940. They started to get less interesting to me once television entered the living room, and there were other sources of visual stimuli and experience. But I found all sorts of things. I mean, people would save candle grease from a candle that had burned down over dinner. There were cigarette stubs. There were lots of wrappers, of candy wrappers and gum wrappers, cigarette wrappers and matchbooks. And of course, I'm trained as a graphic designer, so the typography and the wording and what something cost that you could buy a Hershey bar for 5 cents, all of this was really interesting to me because you could, almost like a forensic analyst, place the person in the place, in the moment, historically, culturally, when they would have found value in that thing. And really what it comes down to, the bigger answer to, I think, your very good question, is that it was really about what people, how people found, located, isolated, identified value and decided what was worth keeping.
I've talked to people about the idea of a curiosity cabinet, where people would actually have cabinets and collect weird stuff. And I think it was kind of a wealthier sort of thing. You can find these oddities. This almost sounds like the home version of that, a very inexpensive way to build your own curiosity collection like that. Is that part of what people were doing?
Also, a cabinet by its very nature is a display case on view for everybody. There's something much more private about a book. You can close the cover, you can put it on a bookshelf, you can lock it away. And many people have asked me if I felt that I was prying when I found these scrapbooks, many of which turned up at garage sales and on eBay. And usually they turn up because the children and the grandchildren don't want them. But what you see when you go through these pages is people trying to make sense of the world, the proximity. What would possess someone to put a prayer card next to a picture of Rudy Valentino? What would possess someone to, you know, put a love letter from someone that they didn't want to admit to being in love with upside down so you can't see the name on the front? There were lots of inverted hinges in these books, lots of sort of covert, cryptic kinds of visual language. And I found all of them really meaningful and very sort of poignant, because secrecy has a long history. And again, not like a curiosity cabinet, these things were really hidden from view in many cases, but they were loved and beloved. And one thing I would add also is that during the Depression, when paper was hard to come by, you would see scrapbooks made on the tops of books that no longer held their service. So, for example, an old math book from a school, or a phone book, or a Sears and Roebuck catalog. And so you would get these kind of layered things where you could, if you read between the cracks, you could see their former use, which I found very powerful.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand about the history of scrapbooks. She's written books, including one called Scrapbooks and American History. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Do you keep scrapbooks now? Have you seen older ones, maybe from a family member that sound kind of like what Jessica is talking about? You can join in at 800-642-1234. So maybe it was different from person to person in the early days, Jessica, but it sounds like maybe people would have treated this as a diary, or might I, if I were a scrapbooker circa 1850, might I have shown it to, you know, a close friend or something like that?
It really depended on your age and a little bit on your gender. I mean, schoolgirls are schoolgirls, and older people tended to be a little more conservative. They were religious scrapbooks. They were scrapbooks just of collections, you know, every picture you could find of the Dion quintuplets. There was for a time in the late 19th century a tendency to keep scrapbooks not only of obituaries, and I mean only death notices, but the more gruesome, the better. There was a kind of strange Schadenfreude that happened where people would save things as if to say, you know, that was them, not me. I'm still standing here. And again, that comes back to this notion of carpe diem. I may not be here tomorrow, but I'm here now. And so the process of gluing something in a book was a way to sort of solidify your own impermanence, your own sense of instability in a world that was spinning out of control. So they really did change. And then you visually, they got really interesting in the early 20th century. And you start seeing people with scissors and they're cutting out heads and they're switching the heads. Long before deepfakes, long before robotics, they were experimenting with selfhood, with romance, with sort of different couplings of things. They're writing poetry. They're circling things. They're tearing things out. There's sort of more composite footage and different kinds of forms of collage. And they get really unruly, which the world was, of course, spinning out of control. You've got, you know, two wars in less than 50 years, and the scrapbooks bore witness to all of it.
Looking at more modern times, I know you like the, you know, sort of everybody was winging it style of these older scrapbooks. And now we have, I think it's fair to call it a scrapbook industry, where somebody uncreative like me could get a scrapbook with lots of prompts in it. And so I know I'm doing it the right way. You think we've lost something there, if I read you right?
I do think we've lost something there. I think everybody does it the right way, and that's precisely its beauty. So the sort of, you know, I've referred to it as a kind of meaningless visual grammar. If you need books and prompts and Martha Stewart and all kinds of things to tell you what paper to buy, I mean, it's a booming industry, and it has a beautiful provenance. If you go back to Mormon culture, the Church of Latter-day Saints, and the desire to really keep track of your family tree. So there's many things to recommend why it demands to be, or deserves at least to be, something we still do today. But I think what got lost with this sort of urgency for some kind of convention, and I mean really not only visual conventions, but conventions where people would come together and have clubs and outings and overnights where you would pay scrapbooking societies to kind of do this with other people, got away from me from the notion that it's actually a very individual pursuit. And that's the beauty. It's your life. It's your parents. It's your school. It's what mattered to you. And just like keeping a yearbook and having your friends sign your yearbook are meaningful to you years later, maybe you tell your children. But the degree of how private it is or personal is up to you. The opportunity is really yours. And I think, you know, to come back to why that's interesting to me is that, you know, I'm trained as an artist and a designer, and I've taught for many years and I've collected for many years. And I was really taken by the degree to which people who were not visually trained felt so compelled to keep these remarkably, I think, idiosyncratic books about their own life experience. So the idea that a visual diarist is in each one of us, to me, is a beautiful, compelling notion about the human spirit and the resolve and the sort of tenacity we have to keep things and save things and make those determinations editorially about proximity and time and space and value.
We're picking up our talk with Jessica Helfand, a graphic designer and founding editor of Design Observer. She's the author of books including Scrapbooks and American History. We're talking about scrapbooking. The history of the hobby goes back further than I had thought, and what scrapbooking looks like now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you now or have you ever been a scrapbooker yourself? Love to hear your story, the kind of things that you put in it, or if you've seen ones in your family, what did they put in maybe back in the day? Do you have a question about how far back this goes and what people did in the early days? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Deborah on the line in Eau Claire. Deborah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What you want to tell us about, Deborah?
A couple of things. I kept a scrapbook when I was in high school in the early to mid-70s and put all kinds of things in there about the Vietnam War. And then when I was in college, I kept it going. But I don't think anybody's ever going to want them, so I don't know even know why I did it. And so the other thing was I kept a COVID-19 journal for the Wisconsin State Historical Society and stuck all kinds of things in there, little pieces of fabric from the masks I made for nurses and stuff. And I guess I just don't know who would even ever care about that except me.
Deborah, thank you so much for calling. Go ahead, Jessica.
I love this. Thank you so much for calling. I think you might be quite surprised. Here at Yale University, where I live, where I taught for many years, the Center for British Art has a curator who's collected all kinds of things from the First World War. And some of the most amazing things are scrapbooks like the one you just described keeping during COVID. Imagine how it will be in the future for students and historians and future biographers to be able to see those fabric swatches. I know from looking back to World War I fabric swatches that for one thing, that the color doesn't fade because they go into books and then someone will come along and see them. And it becomes a whole way to bring history alive again for future generations. The same with your scrapbook that you kept when you were in college and earlier about the Vietnam War. I'm sure there's a historical society or something that will be interested in the fact that you took the time to do that. And I think you should give yourself a big pat on the back.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Deborah. And also what you were saying about the early scrapbookers, Jessica. The whole idea is not to worry about, I think, what somebody else is going to think about it later. This is the thing you're doing for yourself right now.
That's actually a really big piece of it. And I think in a moment when we look so much for consensus, when we are so awash in social media feeds that track our every move, and we're looking at how we and our beliefs align with the beliefs of others, the fact that someone like Deborah would take the time to do that becomes, I think, such a valuable vessel of information for maybe not for right this second, but I think it's fantastic. I wish more people would do it because those are the things that historians will need in the future. And they also allow us to take a pause and really just stop and think about what matters and what has value. And it's not about public consumption. It's about looking at a public moment in a very private way. And that is really the way we experience history, one person at one time doing one thing. And I think that is what gets lost in contemporary scrapbooking. It's what gets lost in contemporary media.
Well, mentioning social media makes me think I came into this conversation thinking, people on their Instagram or the blogs or whatever time period you're in, they're doing what the scrapbookers did. And I am exactly wrong, I think, because that's stuff you're doing with the intention of presenting it to other people as opposed to the scrapbook, which was not that thing.
That is the big difference, I think, Rob. I think you're right. That certainly you look at young people, and I've heard my students say, I put something on Instagram, and if it doesn't get liked, I take it down. The idea that you would have a sentiment or something you wanted to express or share, and you would be so conscious of how it landed for others, as opposed to, something that you feel quite strongly about. And it could be something private, like falling in love or having a baby. All those kinds of things are recorded in people's scrapbooks. But to the degree that what is going on right now in a world spinning out of control, certainly the fact that we're all at home with a lot more me time than any of us ever thought we'd have, and then on the heels of that, protests going on in every city in the country and in Europe and on other continents, it's a time to combine those activities and reflect on what you think is important. And what is important may be quite personal, but you'd be surprised that it might mean something to someone else at another time. And it doesn't have to be broadcast on social media to be meaningful. In fact, quite the opposite.
We're talking to Jessica Helfand, graphic designer, author of the book Scrapbooks in American History. We're talking about the past and present, and if you'd like the future of scrapbooking, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Ben is with us in Chippewa Falls. Ben, hi. Oop, Ben, do we have you there? Doesn't look like it. Okay, let's try a different caller while we see about Ben. How about Irene in Janesville? Irene, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about Irene?
Well, I have a scrapbook I started it in 2016, and it's about Trump and the things going on in this kind of presidency.
And are you putting, like, newspaper clippings and that sort of thing in there, Irene?
They're cartoons from my newspaper and other places. They're all cartoons.
Interesting. Irene, thank you so much. Jessica, I would imagine that there were probably, I don't know, people in the 19th century putting in editorial cartoons about, I don't know, Ulysses S. Grant and others.
Exactly. There's thematic scrapbooks as much as you can imagine. People collect what matters to them, but they become repositories of political history inadvertently, because you're not only seeing what was published on a daily basis in a newspaper or magazine, but what the personification was of politics at that time. What did the cartoonists think? What did the editorial writers think? They tend to be a little one-sided, because as someone who is pro a certain candidate will only save the things they want to go back and revisit. But be that as it may, they still become important documents for those of us who want to know what mattered.
Thanks a lot for that call, Irene, at 800-642-1234. What do you see, Jessica, as a trend these days in scrapbooking and what we might see in the future? Or I guess if people are doing this privately, we won't know what current trends are for another 50 years. I don't know.
We don't, but I think there are a number of artists who work in book form who are interested in how politics and how governance and how social unrest or even personal events can be documented. I wish there were more of those things shared broadly, because I think they show us that they're quite simple. I mean, a lined notebook gives you an opportunity to have a lot of writing. A non-lined notebook means you might want to, you know, be more bold with drawing or pasting things in. But I think that in terms of, at least when I was writing the book, and the book came out 12 years ago, that it was published the day Obama was elected. So I'm a little rusty on what's going on in terms of the social gatherings of scrapbook makers. But it seemed to me that the market, which was a huge bustling market in art supplies, was very much subject to trends and, you know, patterns of things being exhibited by award-winning scrapbook makers, which means, just like anything, you know, there will be certain colors in draperies or colors in scrapbooks. And I think that that has more to do with sort of the publication schedule and the media and the kinds of things that people like. It's not as much, at least it wasn't to me, as tied to the importance of world events or personal events. And I think when people just let themselves feel what they feel and write what they write and think what they think, that's when we get a much more, the veracity of that kind of material over time becomes an incredible testament to the structure of how we observe the world around us. And it's everything from, you know, your caller who just suggested that, I mean, Trump was only elected in 2016. Those cartoons have been coming fast and furious ever since. But there's all sorts of other ways we can save things and things we can choose to save and places to put them, libraries, put them online, share them with students, talk about them, you know, post them. You can actually make a scrapbook and post it on Instagram. But I think the more exciting thing is when you realize that you and your authorship are the sort of important inflection point between a large global event or a series of observations and what you're here to say. And then it's up to you about whether you want to keep that in your family for generations to come upon, or sell it or put it on eBay. But I think increasingly there are libraries around the country that are collecting scrapbooks for just this reason. University of Delaware, when I was writing my book, was a big place that had scrapbooks. I found many of them on eBay, as I said. And I only wrote about American scrapbooks because you can't imagine just what an incredible arsenal of material there is in the United Kingdom. I mean, for people who really want to go deep, I mean, they can go back to the, you know, early 19th century, and the things at the Victoria and Albert Museum are just astonishing. If I had written about British scrapbooks, I would still be writing my book. I wouldn't have published it.
I got to ask, you've written about scrapbooks. You're an artist and a designer yourself. Have you kept scrapbooks, or do you now?
I keep lots of different books. My most favorite book was that I have a daughter who just graduated from college who's always been an inveterate drawer. And we traveled a lot as when my children were young, and we kept a scrapbook we called 10 Things. And it was 10 Things I Know About X. So 10 Things I Know About Poughkeepsie, New York, or 10 Things I Know About India. Wherever we went, we wrote down 10 things. And it became a wonderful collaborative tool for pasting and drawing and saving and remarking on something with a child. And I look at that book now. She looks at it too. And you can track her evolution as an observer in the world. You can track how she became a better wordsmith, how her handwriting changed, the things that she observed, how much better she got, and how much braver she got about expressing herself. And I think I've often thought that that would be a wonderful thing to publish for other families, because sometimes kids are, I think, natural scrapbookers. And I think sometimes they just need a little, they need a little shove. They don't need our guidance, but they need a little support.
Jessica, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Jessica Helfand is an artist, designer, and writer. She's founding editor of Design Observer and the author of several books, including Scrapbooks and American History, and more recently, Face, A Visual Odyssey. She joins us today to talk about the practice of scrapbooking, past and present. You can keep sharing your stories, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.